firearms from someone who currently owns firearms and becomes prohibited. It means ensuring that we have universal background checks so that if someone who is prohibited attempts to purchase firearms or ammunition, that that would show up and they would, in fact, be denied. So, you know, there are several different aspects of what we need to do a better job around policy. And then, of course, we need to
do... We have 10 seconds.
All right. We also need to do a much better job addressing misogyny and domestic violence from the start. That is, recognizing that there's real harm that occurs as a result of gender bias.
Julia Weber, I want to thank you so much for being with us. This clearly needs a much larger discussion. Implementation Director at the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Giffords Law Center, named for Gabby Giffords. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO, Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a new campaign to recall Mayor Ted Wheeler has launched in the city of Portland. A plan to build impermanent structures for the houseless community will go into effect beginning in September, and trans attacks from state legislatures continue to ramp up across the country. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 2nd, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. A Portland-based accountability group has officially launched its Recall Wheeler campaign. Total Recall PAC, an organization dedicated to recalling Mayor Ted Wheeler, has been busy building a coalition of volunteers and raising awareness about the recall effort. Support has come from all over the political spectrum, uniting the city through a desire for new mayoral leadership. Complaints against Wheeler include his violation of campaign finance laws, inadequate handling of police reform and accountability, and the administration's heartless sweeps of houseless communities around the city. The recall team will need to collect over 47,000 signatures to begin the process and is already assembling a canvassing crew that will begin signature collection on July 9th. Audrey Keynes is Total Recall's new campaign manager. She says once the signatures have been collected and verified, quote, by law, the mayor will have a 5-day window to provide a written statement attempting to justify his lack of leadership and unresponsiveness to the social and economic needs of Portlanders. Keynes comes from a background of coordinating grassroots volunteer-based campaigns with multiple environmental and social justice organizations. Total Recall is confident they'll be able to gather the necessary amount of signatures in the required 90 days. As Keynes says, quote, Portland is united in our opposition to Wheeler's failed policies. The well-being of our city, particularly of its most vulnerable residents, requires that the recall campaign succeed quickly. We're taking our responsibility to prepare for that effort seriously. Houseless folks in Multnomah County will be able to utilize 6 new parking and sleeping villages around the city. Commissioner Dan Ryan, who oversees the Joint Office of Homeless Services and is a chief proponent of the plan, said, quote, these villages will provide essential baseline services, laundry, hand washing stations, showers, porta potties, and common areas for food and dialogue, as well as case management. But opponents of the plan argue that it would be more effective, more ethical, and less expensive to house folks in permanent structures rather than building impermanent structures in parking lots. Multnomah County Chair Deborah Cafori signing onto the plan shows a ceasefire in public disagreements between the city and county officials on how best to help the houseless community. Ryan said that construction of the sites will start in September with a goal of having 6 villages built before the year ends. Many details remain unknown, such as the site's locations, their capacities, and how long people will be permitted to stay. Katrina Holland is the executive director of JOIN, an organization committed to supporting the efforts of folks transitioning into permanent housing. She questions whether a strong motivator for the plan is to make downtown and other business areas more commercially appealing, instead of actually focusing on whether the plan will help folks seeking stable housing. Getting higher education while in prison used to be impossible due to unjust legislation in the, quote, tough on crime era. But a new bill passed by Congress will make it easier for students in prison to get so-called second chance Pell Grants. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Oregon News Service.
Getting higher education to people in prison is a struggle for many reasons, chief among them cost. But Congress has made it easier for people behind bars to receive financial help for their schooling. Tucked into an omnibus spending package from December was a bill to restore eligibility for the Second Chance Pell Grant to incarcerated folks who were excluded 26 years ago during the tough on crime era. It starts no later than July 2023, but has operated as a pilot program since 2016 at certain schools, including Chemeketa Community College in Salem, where Jordan Birmingham is executive director of corrections education.
We're making an investment in people that are going to come and be part of the community, and that investment is going to help everybody, including those individuals. So I'm a really staunch supporter of the Second Chance Pell.
Chemeketa is currently the only college in the state in the Second Chance Pell Grant program. It partners with Oregon State and Santiam Correctional Institutions and the Oregon State Penitentiary. Birmingham says the completion rate is around 60% for its associate's degree program, which is four times higher than the school's main campus. According to a RAND Corporation study, every dollar spent on prison education could save taxpayers $4 to $5. But Birmingham cites many hurdles to helping people in prison qualify for Pell Grants. Applications have to be filled out on paper because Oregon limits prison internet access. He says it can also be hard if students have defaulted on past loans.
It can be as little as $5, but they have to make a good faith payment for 9 consecutive months. And getting a check mailed out of prison in regular intervals is just a challenge for our students.
Birmingham says the struggle ultimately pays off. He says a degree helps a person become more employable, more confident, and can even foster better relationships with family members.
We do annual graduations and invite all the families to come, and we live stream it nationwide, actually. And the student speeches at those events, that's really what keeps me and my staff going, and they're pretty amazing.
More than 460,000 people in prison will be eligible for Second Chance Pell Grants, according to the Vera Institute of Justice. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Washington's King County became the first county in the country to ban government use of facial recognition software. King County Council member Dave Upthegrove said of the move, quote, "The use of this technology is invasive, intrusive, racially biased, and full of risk to fundamental civil liberties. The software has often misidentified Black, Asian, and Latinx people. The one exception to the software ban is allowing law enforcement or government agencies to comply with the National Child Search Assistance Act. The ban will not affect the use of that technology by private companies or for personal use. The cities of Portland, San Francisco, and Boston already have similar bans in place. The trans community has faced an unprecedented number of attacks from state legislatures around the country. Most notably, the Montana legislature has passed multiple bills limiting the rights and freedoms of trans people. Here's Eric Tegedoff with more on the story.
The transgender community faced an unprecedented number of attacks from the Montana legislature this session. Advocates say the most notable was a bill that bans trans girls from high school sports, which supporters say protects girls' sports. Opponents note that trans girls outcompeting other girls is a non-existent issue in Montana. Another measure requires people to submit a court order and show proof of surgery in order to change the gender marker on their birth certificates. Sean Rager with Montana Human Rights Network says surgery isn't required to update other documents, including passports and driver's licenses.
And that's for a number of reasons. First of all, a lot of trans folks end up not getting surgery. It's a very personal thing. And in addition to that, it can be difficult to access for a number of folks.
Supporters of the bill say the administration under former Governor Steve Bullock illegitimately changed the administrative rules in 2017, rather than going through the legislature. Anti-trans legislation has been introduced and passed in states across the country. Another measure is designed to increase legal protections for Montanans' religious freedoms, but LGBTQ groups worry it gives cover for discrimination, such as firing someone for their gender identity or sexual orientation. Rager calls the bills a coordinated attack on LGBTQ folks that had little support from the public.
We saw thousands of comments on most of the bills in opposition to them. And we had businesses, physicians, athletes, coaches, parents, and LGBTQ community members testifying against these bills.
Rager notes there was success blocking some bills, including measures that would have prevented trans youth from accessing health care, such as puberty blockers and surgery. He says the session had a high emotional toll. His group has seen an increase in school bullying, anxiety, depression, and calls to suicide crisis centers. Because June is LGBTQ Pride Month, Rager says it's important to let trans, non-binary, and two-spirit Montanans know they belong here, and also improve understanding for people outside of these communities.
So when we think about Pride, there will be a big emphasis on reaching out to individuals, to being able to celebrate as a community, to celebrate our resilience, to celebrate all of the work that we did and the wins that we had.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth look into private versus public health care and the postponement of health care due to cost. That'll be followed at 5:45 by News from the Boo, your look at what's going on inside KBOO with co-interim station manager Jenna Yokoyama. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 58 degrees, and tomorrow expect mostly sunny skies with a high of 79. On this day in 1951, artist and gay rights activist Gilbert Baker was born. Baker is best known for designing the ubiquitous rainbow flag, a worldwide symbol of LGBTQ pride. The quote of the day is from Baker about the power of speaking your truth. He said, quote, "You don't have to live a lie. Living a lie will mess you up. It will send you into a depression. It will warp your values. I came out because I fell in love. It wasn't a terrible, horrible thing. I was in love with somebody, and I wanted to scream it from the rooftops." This past Memorial Day weekend inspired reflection, not just on those who lost their lives to war, but also to police violence. For more, we go to Faven Gerezgihar with the Racial Reckoning Project.
This Memorial Day weekend, people remembered countless lost lives, those lost in military service, and those lost to racial violence.
For much too long, the history of what took place here was told in silence, cloaked in darkness. But just because history is silent, it doesn't mean that it did not take place.
That was President Biden giving remarks Tuesday on the 100-year anniversary of the Tulsa Massacre. In Oklahoma in 1921, a white mob killed hundreds of black residents and burned over 35 blocks of a prosperous black neighborhood. The destruction displaced 10,000 people, yet was largely erased from history.
Some injustices are so heinous, so horrific, so grievous, they can't be buried, no matter how hard people try.
Also this past week, the Canadian government confirmed the discovery of the bodies of 215 Indigenous children in British Columbia. The remains were found on the ground of a residential school that closed decades ago. Such schools were known for forced cultural assimilation, as well as physical and sexual abuse. Historian Peter Ratcliffe said, "This past year has unearthed painful history.
part of this awakening in the last year has also been an awareness of the way the past has been remembered. We're in a great period of awareness that not only do the events in history matter, but how we remember them, how we tell the story of them, how we engage with them is a critical issue.
Ratcliffe said he's hopeful this increased awareness ultimately leads to change, reconciliation, and reparations. For the Racial Reckoning Project, this is Faven Garazghar.
Racial Reckoning, the Arc of Justice, is produced and supported by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, in partnership with KMLJ Radio and the Minnesota Humanities Center.
Numerous memorials have been held after the remains of 215 Indigenous children were discovered in Canada last week. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The grim discovery last week of the remains of more than 200 children at the site of a former residential school in Canada has opened old wounds for First Nations people. Dan Karpinchuk reports on some reactions from former students and calls for action from Native leaders.
The residential school system operated across almost all of Canada. It was designed to assimilate Native children into white society. Those children were taken from their families and forced to attend the government-funded, church-run schools. Thousands were abused. Native historians believe about 4,000 died of neglect and abuse. The undocumented graves of 215 were uncovered on the site of the former residential school in Kamloops, British Columbia. It was proof that what many had talked about or feared was true, that children disappeared from the schools and no one knew why, but they never talked about it. Harvey McLeod is the chief of the Upper Nicola Band and a survivor of the Kamloops residential school.
It was assumed that they ran away and were never going to come back.
McLeod says he remembers children missing but can't remember their names. He says his experience at the school was horrific and life-changing. Over the past couple of days since the discovery, memorials and vigils have sprung up across the country as people, Native and non-Native, honored and grieved for the children as well as survivors and families from the residential schools. George Maristy is a health support worker in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, and a residential school survivor.
I want healing to begin. I want Canada to acknowledge and take responsibility for what happened.
Now, First Nations leaders are calling for an investigation at other residential school sites. Many are certain there are more graves. There were 130 of the schools operating in Canada. Perry Bellegarde is the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations.
But the research and the investigation has to begin at all those 130-plus sites. That's what's got to happen now.
Native leaders say the families of those lost expect answers and need closure to know what happened to the children. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has said his government will help. Reconciliation is one of its priorities. As Angela White, the director of the Indian Residential School Survivors Society, put it, "We may never get the full story of the full number of deaths because documents are missing or destroyed. But more searches would at least give some comfort, even closure, for families." For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Tribal leaders and directors of national Native organizations are applauding Tuesday's U.S. Supreme Court decision involving tribal law enforcement. In the case, U.S. versus Cooley, the court unanimously decided tribal police have the authority to detain a non-Indian traveling on public right-of-way on reservations for violations of state or federal law until non-tribal police can take over custody. In 2016, a tribal officer found a car pulled over on a highway on the Crow Reservation in Montana. The officer thought the driver, Joshua Cooley, seemed intoxicated. A search of the vehicle found drugs and guns. Lower courts ruled evidence should be thrown out because the tribal officer did not have authority since Cooley's non-Indian. Legal experts say the case recognizes tribal inherent jurisdiction over non-Indians for purposes of protecting safety on the reservation. There's mixed reaction to the U.S. Department of the Interior announcing it will suspend oil and gas leases for portions of the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. Some U.S. Democratic lawmakers and the Gwich'in Steering Committee are praising the move, wanting protections for the area, while Alaska's congressional delegation and state's governor are criticizing the Biden administration. They're seeking jobs and an economic boost. The halt is pending the outcome of an environmental review. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Yesterday, the Biden administration suspended several fossil fuel drilling leases that were sold in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge by former President Donald Trump. President Biden also called on Congress to provide permanent protections to one of the planet's most biodiverse areas. The drilling leases are suspended, not canceled. Kristen Miller, acting executive director of the Alaska Wilderness League, said, quote, "Suspending these leases is a step in the right direction, and we commend the Biden administration for committing to a new program analysis that prioritizes sound science and adequate tribal consultation." On his first days in office, Biden imposed a temporary moratorium on oil and gas lease activities, but he has in recent weeks approved hundreds of requests to drill on federal lands, including last week's greenlighting of the ConocoPhillips Large Drilling and Pipeline Project in Alaska's North Slope. The 19.6 million-acre Alaskan Refuge, which is considered sacred by the indigenous Gwich'in communities, is also home to polar bears, caribou, snowy owls, and other wildlife, including migrating birds from six continents. Redrawing a state's political boundaries is required after the census is taken every 10 years, and we've seen politicians, particularly Republicans, abuse this process in an attempt to garner more votes in their favor. In the state of North Dakota, Native American activists are pushing for the inclusion of tribal voices in the redistricting process. Mike Moen has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Next week, North Dakota is expected to choose lawmakers to serve on a panel that will guide the state's redistricting process. As these plans come together, Native American activists are pushing for the inclusion of tribal voices. Redrawing a state's political boundaries is required after each formal census count every 10 years. Native American advocates say the process often leaves their communities with inadequate representation in the state legislature. Nicole Donaghy with the group North Dakota Native Vote says they've requested public hearings on each of the state's five reservations rather than just a handful of other sites not accessible to their members.
We need the committee members to realize that not everybody can drive like 80 miles one direction to go to a hearing.
She says broadband is another access issue, so not everyone can attend the hearings virtually. A key legislative member has said the panel won't have the time to honor the meeting's request. Donaghy says they're trying to coordinate with tribal governments in hopes they will be consulted as the new legislative maps are created. Being told there isn't enough time or that tribal members should participate virtually, Donaghy says only underscores the need for more inclusion. She sees it as a reflection of non-Native settlers' attitude since they first arrived in the region, a tone she says has persisted.
They think that we're only interested in the federal policy because it affects our tribal lands, but state legislation also affects our lands.
She says tribal areas often end up being represented by a legislator with the opposite views on important policies, including environmental issues. Native Americans make up roughly 5% of North Dakota's population, but only 1% of state lawmakers. Donaghy says the state should look to Montana as a redistricting model, where the process is overseen by an independent commission. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
In his never-ending commitment to keeping the status quo, Mitch McConnell continues to mock progressive ideas, saying defunding the police is, quote, one of the dumbest ideas America's ever seen. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Economic inclusion, I firmly believe, is among the defining economic issues of our time.
The White House has a new plan to narrow the racial wealth gap, which includes addressing inequity in home appraisals and conducting rulemaking to combat housing discrimination. Rafael Bostic with the Atlanta Federal Reserve says a more inclusive economy is a more prosperous economy.
According to J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, eliminating longstanding racial inequities in income could boost U.S. economic output by $2.3 trillion a year.
Charles Neer with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says the typical white family has eight times the wealth of the typical black family.
One of the primary explanations for the large racial wealth gap is the historical and structural discrimination in the credit markets. It's potentially 50% of that gap, with the remainder being income and to a smaller extent, education.
President Joe Biden announced a new initiative while marking the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre when, over an 18-hour period, a mob of white people attacked residents and burned businesses in a predominantly black neighborhood.
We know here, in this hallowed place, we simply can't bury pain and trauma forever. And at some point, there'll be a reckoning, an inflection point, like we're facing right now as a nation.
100-year-old Hughes Van Ellis, who was among the remaining survivors, says the years that followed were filled with injustices.
My family was driven out of our home. We were left with nothing.
Historians estimate that 300 people died and more than 1,200 homes burned. Back in D.C., Biden will meet with Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito today to discuss infrastructure. Talks with Republicans continue over a legislative package's price tag and what will be included. Senate Democrats and Republicans are still hammering out the details of a criminal justice bill at an event in his home state of Kentucky on Tuesday. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said more funding is needed to stem rising crime.
The abuse that's been heaped on law enforcement over the last year is unfortunate. I think defunding the police has got to be one of the dumbest ideas.
Major sticking points in the negotiations are qualified immunity, a legal shield for officers, and changes to Section 242, the criminal standard for convicting law enforcement. In election news, Vice President Kamala Harris is now the White House's point person for voting rights. Noting that almost 400 bills have been introduced at the state level restricting voting access, Harris said she'll work to ensure a free, fair, and transparent process. Democrats are keeping the New Mexico congressional seat left vacant by newly appointed Interior Secretary Deb Haaland in a special election Tuesday. Democrat Melanie Stansbury beat Republican opponent State Senator Mark Moores. And Florida's only statewide elected Democrat filed paperwork to challenge Republican Governor Ron DeSantis in 2022. Democratic Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried would face a former governor, Congressman Charlie Crist, in the primary. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
Utility providers in Switzerland got their customers to buy renewable energy. After they made the change, participation in clean energy programs in the country skyrocketed. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Utility customers in Switzerland have been helping the climate by doing nothing at all. Over the past decade, many Swiss utilities have started automatically providing customers with renewable electricity. So clean energy is now the default source, and consumers have to opt out if they don't want it. A recent study shows that this switch greatly increases participation in clean energy programs.
We found a massive effect.
That's Ulf Liebe, a researcher at the University of Warwick in the UK. His team studied over 200,000 Swiss households and businesses. He says before their utility made the switch, less than 3% of customers opted in to use renewable electricity. Shortly afterwards, however, that number skyrocketed to over 80%, even though renewable energy was more expensive. And 4 years after the switch, most of the customers were still going green. Liebe says this is not surprising given human nature.
We have a tendency to stick to the status quo. And if someone is defining something as a standard, then we are quite willing to accept that.
Liebe says utilities in other countries could also switch the default energy customers receive to help speed the transition to clean energy. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
The coronavirus pandemic has sparked a greater interest in the healthcare profession among job seekers. The growth in interest is also attached to a greater demand for care for the country's aging population. Even so, Oregon and other states face difficulty with their nursing infrastructure, particularly in getting interested and qualified students connected with training programs. Nursing schools in the U.S. turned away 80,000 qualified applicants in 2019 because they lacked teachers, classroom space, and clinical placements. That's according to the American Association of Colleges of Nursing. For more on the increased interest in healthcare work, we go to Dr. Mark Allenderry with COVID Noise Filter.
Healthcare jobs on the rise. Now, healthcare jobs are expected to grow 15% in the next decade, which is faster than average of all other occupations. Reason for this massive growth are longer lifespans, aging populations, and the growth of chronic conditions. Now, with the pandemic, this number could expand even more, according to the New York Times. There's an increased attention to health. Researchers at LinkedIn were studying jobs that had been pushed by the pandemic. They found that the pandemic had intensified the demand for certain healthcare positions, the first being nurse practitioners, followed by home health and personal care aides, mental health specialists, massage therapists, and respiratory therapists. nurse practitioners, the overall growth of nurse practitioners is expected to be greater than 50% in the next decade, with a shift of focus to preventative care and care for the aging population. The Bureau of Labor Statistics is predicting that 11 million additional nurses are needed to avoid further shortage. Home health and personal care aides. Overall employment in this group is expected to increase by 34% because of the aging boomer generation and the growing elderly population. This group of workers is the sixth fastest growing occupation in the country. President Biden is planning to address the industry's low wages and invest in the infrastructure of caregiving, whether in a private home, assisted living, or nursing homes. Mental health specialists. This group of healthcare jobs is expected to grow by 25%. Some of the fastest growing positions include behavior therapists, mental health technicians, and psychotherapists, but other jobs include social workers and risk reduction managers. Massage therapists. This field is expected to grow by 21% as more providers learn the benefits of massage in conjunction with treatment plans. For instance, gentle massage in older patients can assist with relaxation and circulation. Respiratory therapists. This field is expected to grow by 19%. They focus on heart and lung problems, and the increased development of chronic conditions, there's an increased need for respiratory therapists. Lastly, I do want to talk about what people are referring to as the Fauci effect. We are seeing increases in medical school and in public health school as well, largely due to the pandemic. And it's great that we are seeing more young people, especially more young people of color, that are looking toward the STEM sciences, but particularly medicine and public health as career options. And as my co-host, Doc Griggs, says, come on in, the water is warm.
That was Dr. Mark Allendary from COVID Noise Filter speaking about increased interest in the healthcare field. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael knows which way the wind blows.
Welcome to June. Or is it July? Record dry April and May. I don't want to think beyond the week as a third state puts its hands around democracy's throat. It seems like those who complain the most about cancel culture want to do the biggest cancel of all, of voters, as if voting for a Democrat is politically incorrect, morally offensive. Democracy is already canceled by the lazy man's racist-based filibuster and a Senate where Wyoming, with 1.5% of California's population, gets the same number of senators. Though so much out-of-state money failed to defeat Peter DeFazio, what happens next year? What won't the police and powerful do to keep Joanne Hardesty from being reelected? A drought of democracy will mean a famine of freedom, as every state is going through unmannered gerrymandering where the maps will look more like Jackson Pollock than geometry. Let the rain of sustained creative protest, a deluge of voters flooding the ballot boxes, make those fake maps and those who drew them run and fade down the drain. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 2nd, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Doug McVeigh. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Dr. Mark Allendary, The Racial Reckoning Project, Antonia Gonzalez, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, Mike Moen, Mary Sherman, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 9, it's Fight the Empire, connecting history with the latest world events. At 9:30, tune in for Radio Zine, which brings a variety of intriguing public affairs programming. And at 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio delving into corporate criminality, human rights, and economic justice. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for an in-depth report on how people with private health insurance are more likely to experience medical debt and to postpone care because of costs than people who have public health insurance like Medicare and Medicaid.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
People who have employer-provided or privately purchased health insurance are more likely to experience medical debt and more likely to postpone care because of cost, compared to those who are covered by public insurance such as Medicare or Medicaid. Those are some of the conclusions in new research published this week in the medical journal JAMA Open Network. KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with the lead author, Dr. Charlie Ray, an assistant professor of medicine at UC San Francisco Medical School.
So my name is Dr. Charlie Ray. I am a hospitalist and health services researcher at the San Francisco VA and the University of California, San Francisco, an assistant professor of medicine at UCSF, interested in health policy research, and then also the intersectionality of telemedicine and its use and its impact on socially vulnerable patients. And so I spend most of my time doing health services research, and then I'm also a clinician and educator here in San Francisco.
You're the lead author of a new article that's in the June 1st edition of the journal JAMA Network Open, Access to Care, Cost of Care, and Satisfaction with Care Among Adults with Private and Public Health Insurance in the U.S. Now, what were you and your colleagues trying to determine?
So the basis of this paper in this exploration was really around the notion that we believe that most Americans, if you polled most Americans and asked them, if you had a choice between health insurance, taking a public option, i.e. Medicare, Medicaid, or being cared for at the VA, or you could have private health insurance through your employer or purchased on an open market, which would you pick? And the vast majority of people, at least in prior studies, have shown that most people would end up choosing a private health insurance plan. But if you sort of look back at historical trends and historical data, you actually see that the quality of public health insurance options oftentimes supersedes that of private health insurance options. And so what we wanted to do was say, look, oftentimes the data that show that are done just through polls. So they just poll people and ask, how do you like it? How do you like your health insurance, or how do you dislike it? But what those polls often don't do is they don't do risk adjustment. So they don't adjust for how sick an individual might be. And if you think about why that's important, is sick people tend to use their insurance more frequently than healthy people. So if you ask a bunch of healthy people, do you like your insurance? Of course they're going to say, yes, I like my insurance. Why? Because they never use it. But if you ask sicker individuals if they like their insurance, they may give you a little bit of pushback. Why? Because they're forced to interact with those bureaucracies and those insurance firms. And so that's why adjustment is really important in these situations. And so what we did was essentially ask similar questions around access to care, costs of care, and overall satisfaction, but we adjusted for people's underlying health status to give us a really balanced idea of whether or not people truly like having private health insurance or versus public health insurance.
Or what kind of population were you looking at?
Yeah, so what this does, so what we used is it's called the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. It is a national survey that is given every single year, and has been done so for something like 40 years at this point in time. All states provide this survey, and different states ask different questions, but there are a good number of questions that overlap between states. We looked at the years between 2016 through 2018, so we looked at a three-year slice of this data. And we had a total of 150,000 people who answered the survey questions that we utilized. And the important thing that 150,000 people ends up representing a little over 60 million adults. So about one in five Americans are potentially represented in this population.
So now, what did you find?
So there's nuance here. And I'll start by saying, so we looked at three primary domains. So we looked at questions questions that surveyed individuals around three domains. Access to care, oftentimes meaning access to a primary care physician, costs of care, and overall satisfaction with care. And then we looked across two sort of sub-segments, public health insurance and private health insurance. within the public health insurance domains. That included, you know, the very common Medicare, Medicaid, and veterans health insurance. And private health insurance, we looked at individuals who had, again, insurance purchased on open markets, or those who received it through their employer. So I will say that around 80% of the people who had private health insurance received it from their employer, just to sort of set the groundwork for that. And what we did is sort of compared across these two groups, across these three domains of access, costs, and satisfaction. And what we ended up finding was that individuals with private health insurance, when you compared them to people with public health insurance, in particular, I'll talk about Medicare right now, because Medicare is, of course, a very large beneficiary for many Americans. We found that people with private health insurance had a lower likelihood to have a personal physician. They were more likely to report instability in insurance coverage. They had higher difficulty seeing a doctor. They had greater difficulty taking medication due to cost. And they had higher medical debt. And not only that, they were less satisfied. So the common notion that people who have private health insurance, like that insurance coverage more so than those who might have Medicare, is at least in this study questionable at best.
Just to clarify, you were looking at Medicare, but also other public health systems, the Medicaid, et cetera?
That's right. So when we looked at the Medicaid, when we compared individuals with Medicaid to private health insurance, the results were certainly more, they were more, we had mixed results there, a little bit more nuanced. And while in certain places we showed that they had more or less satisfaction, the one thing that we walked away with was that compared to Medicaid, individuals with private health insurance had greater medical debt. So they ended up spending more on their healthcare costs than those who had Medicaid. The trouble with the Medicaid data is that Medicaid, as you probably know, is provided on a state-by-state basis. So there's heterogeneity amongst all the states. So finding a consistent signal about whether or not individuals with Medicaid truly had better access to care or cost or satisfaction compared to private health insurance is a difficult question to ask with this data set, because we were looking at a national level, but Medicaid operates at a state level. But we largely said, but what we could walk away with was that at the best, people with private health insurance had more medical debt than those who were on Medicaid.
Now, so more medical debt, that high cost also a lot of times means foregone care. How did that stack up?
That's right. So individuals, when you talk about foregone care, it's people making the decision whether or not to go see a physician or to purchase medicines. And how does insurance access sort of affect that? And what we showed was, again, both in individuals who had private health insurance were frequently not going to see their doctor or were not going to purchase medications because costs were so high. And again, that pushes back against that common narrative that private health insurance is better than a public health insurance option.
And so overall, just in terms of individual satisfaction, people preferred their public insurance.
That's right. When you look at the public health insurance options, basically across the board, be it Medicare and even more particularly amongst individuals who were covered by VA healthcare, both of these populations and even some subpopulations within Medicaid had much higher satisfaction rates than those who had private health insurance. And again, it's really important to note here that, again, we controlled for individuals' underlying health status. So we are essentially leveling off whether or not people are going to see the doctor or not. And what that does is allow us to make a nice, even comparison across these different populations.
Can you speculate? I mean, do you have any thoughts about the implications of your findings for health policy and healthcare reform?
Yeah, that's a good question, Doug. So I will preface that, you know, the U.S. about every 10 to 15 years goes through in-depth discussions about how we should think about potential healthcare reform. We're in a nadir, I think, at this point, whereas it is not an important discussion, at least on the political spectrum at this point in time. But what we would hope is that when this discussion does pop up again in the near future, and I imagine the current administration may be more open to discussing alterations here, that we take a step back, and when we say what sort of options should the American public have, we should also present the data that, look, when we ask around these domains, these important domains that are important to consumers, access to a primary care physician, how much the costs of your medications, and are you satisfied with the product that you have, that if we present data that gives people options that, sorry, let me back up. If we present data around the domains of access, cost, and satisfaction, we can let consumers choose which options they have. And if a Medicare option should come about, we believe that this data may be helpful in at least validating or giving some support to that sort of pathway.
And folks, have been speaking with Dr. Charlie Reyes with the Department of Medicine at UC San Francisco and also with the Division of Hospital Medicine at the San Francisco Veterans Affairs Medical Center. He's lead author of Access to Care, Cost of Care, and Satisfaction with Care Among Adults with Private and Public Health Insurance in the U.S., which was published in the June 1st edition of the journal JAMA Network Open. Dr. Ray, thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Reporting for KBOO News, this is Doug McVeigh.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland.